Today's title is Samuel Called and Yahweh Sent Thunder and Rain.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. We're going to look this morning at some of the words of the 1st of Samuel chapter 12. So we might just turn there because we're going to focus on this chapter for essentially the whole of our study this morning. Under the title, as our chairman has announced, Samuel called unto Yahweh and Yahweh sent thunder. We're going to, in fact, pick up the record in the 1st of Samuel chapter 11 and in the 14th verse, which really leads into the words and the speech of Samuel in the 1st of Samuel chapter 12. In the 1st of Samuel, then, chapter 11, and verse 14 we read, Then said Samuel to the people, Come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. Now the background to this, of course, was that Saul had just won a marvelous victory against one of the enemies of Israel. And as a result of that, the nation had rejoiced. And now there's going to be a formal inauguration, a formal crowning, as it were, of Saul to be king. And that will lead to the story of the 1st of Samuel 12, which really we might entitle Samuel's Resignation Speech. That's what this chapter's all about. You see, Samuel's Resignation Speech. It's the moment when he formally hands over the reins of government and responsibility to the young king. Now, in the 14th verse here of the 11th chapter, you'll see the spirit of Samuel. What a wonderful spirit it was. He says, Let's go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. And of course, you see, I think he has in mind that it was in Joshua chapter 5 and verse 10 that Israel had made a new start before their God. They'd begun afresh. They'd entered into the land and they'd started to make covenant with their God that they might be faithful to him. And you can see the spirit of Samuel here. As the people wish to make Saul king, he says, well, let's do this. Let's do this right. Let's get back. To where it all began. Let's go back to Gilgal. Let's start afresh. Let's make a new beginning. You see the spirit of Samuel. It's a marvelous thing, isn't it? You see, there's no desire, there's no sadness on Samuel's part for the loss of his own prestige. There's no difficulty that Samuel has that another man is about to take his place, and a lesser man than he. Samuel's only desire is that which shall be best for the truth, best for Israel. Let's make a fresh start, he says. Let's go back to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there, he says. And so verse 15 says, All the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before Yahweh in Gilgal. And there they sacrificed sacrifices of peace offerings before Yahweh. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Actually, the Septuagint version says at the end of that verse, There Samuel and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. I'm not sure whether that's a better translation or not, but I'm sure that it's true. In other words, I'm sure that Samuel rejoiced on that day as well as Saul. There was no hateful spirit of envy in Samuel, no bitterness. Just a desire that whatever would be best for Israel would give him happiness. Just an interesting note, by the way, on the peace offerings of verse 15. Do you know that peace offerings were always offered with leaven? And the lesson of that, you see, was that our fellowship with God, because that's what the peace offering stands for, is never to be found on the basis of human perfection. There was always leaven offered with them. And the other interesting thing about the peace offering is that the fat of the peace offering was never burnt on its own. The fat of the peace offering was always burnt with something else. In fact, it was burnt with the fat of the burnt offering. So the fat of the peace offering was taken and in fact placed on top of the fat of the burnt offering each day. And the burnt offering, of course, symbolizes fellowship. And the lesson of all this was that the Father does extend fellowship to those who, despite their sinfulness, leaven is offered, wish to dedicate themselves to Him, the burning of the fat. And here in Gilgal, the people confess before God their desire for fellowship with him, to be dedicated to him as they renew the kingdom and crown Saul as king, and they all rejoiced greatly. And then the old man stood up to offer his resignation speech, you see, in the 1st of Samuel and chapter 12. Now, I've already made the decision that I will be unable to complete this chapter, which is good, because now I can relax, you see, in the knowledge that I can't do it anyway. And so therefore, what we're going to do is perhaps give a break-up of the chapter, and then we're going to look at the first few verses in particular, and then I'm just going to sketch out one or two highlights from the rest of the chapter, bearing in mind that the principal thing we want to try and do is extract the exhortations from Samuel's own life. What are the lessons from the man himself? Well, first then, a break-up of the chapter. Verses 1 to 5 is really, we might entitle, Samuel's claim of integrity. That's how he begins his speech. Samuel's claim of integrity. He starts by making claim concerning the purity of the work that he has performed in Israel over the course of his life. Not from any sense of pride, but so that they might listen to him. And then in verses 6 to 11, he's going to deal with what we might entitle lessons from the epoch of the judges. You see, this is Samuel, the last judge, looking back now over the era that he is closing. The last of the judges looks back and reviews the lesson of that time period of Israel's history. What were the lessons from the epoch of the judges? Verses 6 to 11. And then verses 12 to 13, Israel's sin in asking for a king. Israel's sin in asking for a king. He's going to tell them that. He's going to say that he believes that. In fact, he's going to prove that in this chapter, that their spirit in asking for a king was really a matter of sin. And then we might really say verses 14 right to the end of the chapter, although there's going to be a sort of a parenthesis in the middle, but verses 14 to 25 is really Samuel's counsel for king and people. Samuel's counsel for king and people. What are the great issues that they needed to think about as the kingdom began under the monarchy? But sandwiched in the middle of that, verses 16 to 19, which are sort of in the middle of that section, we might describe as the lesson of the thunder. The lesson of the thunder, right in the middle of Samuel's counsel. Well, we hope, God willing, to be able to sketch out at least the main ideas in all of those sections, but we're going to start by looking in a little bit more detail at verses 1 to 5 and Samuel's claim of integrity. You see what he says. Verse 1, Samuel said unto all Israel, Behold, I have hearkened unto your voice in all that ye said unto me, and have made a king over you. And so he had, but remember that he'd only done this because God had thrice commanded him to do so in chapter 8, verse 7, in chapter 8, verse 9, and in chapter 8, verse 22. So, you see, when Samuel said, I've hearkened unto your voice, he'd really hearkened to God's voice, hadn't he? He'd responded to the instructions of God. That was the only reason that Samuel was interested in doing this, because he had become convinced that this was the divine choice, the divine purpose, that God would go along with the particular request of the nation at this time for the establishment of a king. Now, one thing we haven't mentioned in our studies so far, but I think maybe this is the right time to do so, and that's to say this, that, you see, the name Samuel is actually made up of the Hebrew words Shema and Ael. Shema Ael. Shema Ael. Now, Shema, of course, well, you know what the great word Shema is. Shema Yisrael from Deuteronomy. Hear, O Israel. So, Shema Ael, in its normal form, would be Hear God. But Josenius tells us that in the particular form it's found in Samuel's name, the word Shema is in its passive form. And therefore, it's not Hear God, it's Heard of God. Heard of God. And I think that there's a play on the name of Samuel all the way through his life. And that these were the twin principles of Samuel's life. Hear God, heard of God. He heard God's voice all his life, did this man. But he, in turn, when he prayed to the Father, was heard of God. And there was this intimate communication between the prophet and his God. He was the man who listened to the voice of his God and who in turn responded with his own pleadings to the Father, and the Father in turn heard his voice. And we're going to see some of those principles of prayer and intercession in this very chapter. So we're going to find that that's a key idea, this idea of hearing God and heard of God, and we'll come back to that shortly in the context of this particular chapter. So he says, I've hearkened unto your voice, I've made you a king. And so he had, but really only because he'd heard God's voice asking him to do this. In verse 2 he says, And now behold, the king walketh before you, and I am old and grey-headed, and my sons are with you, and I have walked before you from my childhood unto this day. I'm old and grey-headed, says Samuel. A couple of interesting quotations, which we might just turn up, actually, with regard to the spirit of that. In Proverbs chapter 16, we read these words in the 31st verse. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 31. And this is a good reference to Samuel, because he was certainly a fulfillment of this principle. I am old and grey-headed, he says. Now, Proverbs 16, verse 31 says, the hoary head is a crown of glory if it be found in the way of righteousness. And the word hoary head here is derived from the same root Hebrew for the word grey-headed. So you see that the person who was hoary-headed or grey-headed in the truth, well, that was a matter of glory, of honour, as long as it was found in the way of righteousness, which, of course, Samuel was, wasn't he? In Leviticus chapter 19, we have a similar reference, probably worth looking up again. In Leviticus chapter 19, in the law had somewhat to say about the same matter. And it put it this way. In Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 32, the law had said this, thou shalt rise up before the hoary head, and honour the face of the old man, and fear thy God. I am Yahweh. Thou shalt honour, or thou shalt rise up before the hoary head, and honour the face of the old man. So you see, I think one of the reasons why Samuel says, I'm old and grey-headed, is what he's saying is, you ought to listen to me. I'm the hoary head. I'm in the way of righteousness. I'm worthy of your respect. You should pay attention to the words that I'm about to tell you in the coming chapter. Not from any pride, but because he earnestly wanted the nation to hearken to him. So I think that's one reason why he refers to himself as being old and grey-headed. And I think there's another reason as well. If you come to Psalm 71, I think there's another reason, you see, why he mentions the fact that he's grey-headed. Psalm 71 puts it this way, firstly reading from verse 9, and then from verses 17 and 18. Psalm 71, 9, and then 17, 18. Cast me not off in the time of old age, forsake me not when my strength faileth. O God, thou hast taught me from my youth, and hitherto have I declared thy wondrous works. And now also, when I am old and grey-headed, O God, forsake me not, until I have showed thy strength unto this generation, and thy power to everyone that is to come. You see, isn't the idea here in the psalm of being old and grey-headed that one feels the failing of one's powers? You see verse 9, when my strength faileth. And Samuel felt this, you see. He truly felt those advancing years come upon him. And so when in the first of Samuel here, in chapter 12 and verse 2, he says, and now I'm old and grey-headed, I think both of those ideas are present in what Samuel is saying. Firstly, that they owed him respect. And secondly, that he confesses the note here of his personal weakness and the failing of his power. Of course, it was that had led him in chapter 8, verse 1, wasn't it, to make his sons judges. Do you remember that? It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges. Well, they turned out to be a disgrace, hadn't they? They turned out to be those who accepted bribes, who were in the way of covetousness. How hurt and how upset Samuel was, we remember, when the nation came and said, "Thy sons walk not in thy ways." Now you see what he says here then in the second verse of chapter 12. He says, "I'm old and grey-headed, and behold, my sons are with you." Now what exactly does that mean? Well, some have suggested that it means that the proof that he was old is that his sons were there, grown up. Another suggestion that's been made, and I think this is a good one, is that the significance of the phrase, "Behold, my sons are with you," is that Samuel is telling us here that he had deprived his sons of their public office. He had removed them from the judgeship and had left them as common people. They were among the common people. "My sons are with you." They're no longer judges. I've removed them. Because he knew the judgment against Eli, you see, that his sons made himself wicked, but that Eli restrained them not. I don't think Samuel was going to do that. He may have had a problem with his sons, but he wasn't going to repeat the mistake of Eli. So he says, "I have removed them from office. Left them for the people to judge as they saw fit. Reduced to the common rank of the ordinary man." Yes, I think that Samuel here is showing his consistency and integrity in the matters of the truth. You know, sometimes even in ecclesial life, blood tends to flow a little bit thicker than the water of the word, doesn't it? And it ought not to. The principles of the truth should always assume priority. Maternal and paternal affection should never override divine principles. And it doesn't in the life of Samuel, does it? He upholds that which is just and righteous. And so he says, and in the end of verse 2, "I've walked before you from my childhood unto this day." He claims that he'd been absolutely consistent, you see, all his life. And so in verse 3, "Behold, here I am," he says, "witness against me before Yahweh and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose ass have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind mine eyes therewith? And I will restore." Actually, there's something interesting about all this, because you see, this idea of whose ox have I taken and so on, if you come back to Numbers 16 for a moment, you'll find there's a Bible echo here of an earlier occasion in the matter of Korah, Dathan and Abiram. In the days of Numbers 16, you'll know that Korah staged a rebellion against Moses. He sought the leadership, didn't he? And Moses was deeply upset by the challenge of Korah. Not because Moses wanted the leadership, but because of the spirit of Korah, who desired the preeminence in the nation. And we're told in Numbers chapter 16 and verse 15, it says, "Moses was very wroth and said unto Yahweh, Respect not thou their offering. I've not taken one ass from them," says Moses. "I haven't taken one ass from them," he cries. "I've been absolutely pure." And now we have the same words, you see, out of the mouth of Samuel. You know what's really interesting about that? Who was challenging Moses in Numbers 16? And the answer is Korah. Do you know where Samuel comes from? Samuel is of the line of Korah. And now a man of Korah, in the first of Samuel 12, says to the nation, "Whose ass have I taken, or whose ox have I taken?" And the wheel has come full circle, and the man of Korah is now in the position of authority and responsibility. And yet, funnily enough, he shows the same spirit of integrity as did Moses of old. And I think both these men, you see, both Moses and Samuel, were not immune from the feelings of relinquishing the guidance of Israel into the hands of other men. By the way, the fact that he was of the sons and the lineage of Korah, we know that from Numbers 26, verse 11, and from the first of Chronicles, chapter 6, verses 22 through 28. And so Samuel says in this verse, verse 3 of the 1st of Samuel 12, he says at the end of the verse, "Or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind mine eyes therewith?" Now you know what he's claiming there? He's claiming his purity of character in terms of executing the responsibility of being a judge. If you come back to the law for a moment and to Deuteronomy chapter 16, you'll remember that, well, you see, there were famous words in the book of Deuteronomy about what the judges ought to be like. And this is what it says in Deuteronomy 16, verses 18 to 20. It says, "Judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which Yahweh thy God giveth thee, throughout thy tribes. And they shall judge the people with just judgment. Thou shalt not wrest judgment. Thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift, for a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise, and pervert the words of the righteous. That which is altogether just shalt thou follow." So judges were specifically precluded, says the record, from accepting gifts or bribes that would pervert the integrity of their judgment. And therefore, you see, what Samuel is saying here in chapter 12 and verse 3 is that he'd done just that. He'd been absolutely consistent to the requirements of the law of Moses. He had purity of character in terms of discharging his responsibilities. And verse 4 says, the people respond, "Thou hast not defrauded us, nor oppressed us, neither hast thou taken aught of any man's hand." And so the people acknowledge that the very things that Samuel has said here were true about... Do you know, brothers and sisters, there's not one single thing recorded against Samuel in the divine record. There's not one sin recorded against the life of Samuel. He stands in the divine record as a man of absolute integrity in all his dealings. And he claims that now before the nation. And so verse 5 says, "And he said unto them, Yahweh is witness against you, and his anointed is witness, that ye have not found aught in my hand." And the people said, "Witness." You see the words "he is," they're not there. And the people meekly admit at the end that he was absolutely right in everything he said. Now you see, there's a principle that comes out of all this. You see, I think what we've got here is the story of, I've entitled it here, Samuel the Upright. Just have a look at this. So you see, there are three things that Samuel claims as he begins his resignation speech. Here they are. Samuel the Upright, in protesting the matter of his own integrity, there were three things, you see, that he says there. Firstly, in the second verse, he proclaims his consistency. "I've walked before you from childhood unto this day. I've never changed my principles. I've been a man of consistency," he says. Then in the third verse, he claims the matter of purity. "I've never taken anything. I've never advantaged myself from the office. I've never perverted my judgment with bribes. I've been absolutely pure in the discharge of my office." And finally here, in the fifth verse, he says, "Yahweh is witness and his anointed is witness that ye've not found aught of my hand." And so he claims absolute integrity of character in what he has done. Now let me show you something interesting. I should take this back off for a moment. Do you remember this overhead that we showed right at the start? What we said is that there were a whole series, you see, of trailblazers, remember? And who were the trailblazers? Moses, Samuel, Elijah, John, Paul. And these men are, I think, sort of bound together in the record. They were the great trailblazers, you see, and you'll find them quoting one another, alluding to one another, because they probably felt a kinship of spirit with the labors of those other men. Well, here is one such example, because just have a look at this. You remember in the New Testament, a man came to a place and he called the elders of an ecclesia together and he gave them his final speech. Not his resignation speech, but the final words he would ever offer them. Who was the man? Paul. Who were the elders? Ephesus. Where did they meet? Miletus. And he's never going to see them again, is he? He's going to offer them his last words, just as did Samuel. Now look at this. In the first of Samuel, chapter 12 and verse 2, Samuel says, I'm old and grey-headed, and I've walked before you from my childhood unto this day. And Paul says, I've been with you at all seasons, serving the Lord, ye all among whom I have gone. And he claims, on exactly the same basis as Samuel, that he had consistency of character in all his dealings with them. In the first of Samuel, chapter 12 and verse 3, Samuel had said, whose ox have I taken? Whose ass? Whom have I defrauded? Of whose hand have I received a bribe? In Acts chapter 20, Paul says, I've coveted no man's silver or gold or apparel. Ye yourselves know that these hands have ministered unto my necessities. I'm pure, he says. And Samuel says in the first of Samuel, chapter 12 and verse 5, Yahweh is witness this day that ye have not found aught in my hand. And Paul says in Acts 20 and verse 26, wherefore I take you to record this day that I am pure from the blood of all men. Would you say there's an echo there, a Bible echo? Oh yes, I think so. You see, Paul felt a kinship of spirit with Samuel in terms of the famous words of his resignation speech here as he spoke to the elders of Ephesus in Acts chapter 20. Same principles, you see. Exactly the same principles were to be observed in the lives of both men. Well, as we said before, brothers and sisters, we're not going to have time to look at the rest of the chapter in detail, and so we might just pick up one or two of the highlights of the verses that follow. In verses 6 to 11, then, what Samuel is going to do is he's going to summarize the lesson of the epoch of the judges. And many of you will know the story of this because it's been found in study notes and so on, but it's worthy of review, I think, again. And basically what Samuel is going to say is this. He says, look, the whole of this epoch of time in the history of the nation has been a cycle of events. And if you don't understand this cycle, then having a king won't make you any better. If you don't understand the lesson of the judges, says Samuel, then you'll be doomed to repeat the same problems whether you've got a king ruling over you or not. And this was the great lesson of the era of the judges, and that was this, in simple words, that sin brings suffering, but supplication brings salvation. So there it is. That's the whole lesson of the book of Judges summarized, isn't it? That sin brings suffering, but supplication brings salvation. Now, in those verses 6 to 11, you'll see that's really exactly what Samuel summarizes in those verses. That's what he's talking about, the lesson of the epoch of the judges. And he says, if you can't learn that lesson, then you're going to continue to have problems, he says. Just an aside, by the way, concerning verse 11. You'll notice in verse 11 that it says, and Yahweh sent Jerubbaal and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you. Now, who was Jerubbaal? Well, Jerubbaal was in fact Gideon, wasn't he? So, who did Gideon deliver Israel from? Does anybody know? From the Midianites. Now, where did the Midianites come from? And the answer is they came from the south. So here was a judge who delivered Israel from the great enemy, or one of the great enemies, to the south, Jerubbaal. And then along came Bedan. But the Septuagint version and the Syriac Peshitta text and the Arabic manuscripts read Barak for Bedan. And who did Barak deliver Israel from? And the answer is, according to Judges 4, he delivered them from the Canaanites. Now, where did the Canaanites come from? The answer is they came from the north. Their base of operation was from the north. They were one of the great enemies to the north. And then along came Jephthah, says the record. Now, Jephthah delivered Israel from the hands of the Ammonites. We're told that in Judges 11, verses 32 to 33. Now, the Ammonites were, of course, on the other side of Jordan, weren't they? So they were on the east. And finally he says, Yahweh sent me, Samuel. And who did Samuel deliver Israel from? He delivered them from the Philistines, or as you say over here, the Philistines. And the Philistines, of course, were on the west. So you see, the four judges, I think, that are brought together in the 11th verse here are those who delivered from the Midianites to the south, the Canaanites to the north, the Ammonites to the east, the Philistines to the west. And you see what the verse goes on to say. He says, Yahweh sent all of these judges and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side. And so he had. With these remarkable men that had been raised up to give them victory when they sought Yahweh and cried unto him with all their heart. And so he says that if you don't understand that, you've got a difficulty. Verses 12 and 13, he says, look, this matter of kingship is a sin. When ye saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, ye said unto me, nay, but a king shall reign over us, when Yahweh your God was your king. Now therefore, behold the king whom ye have chosen and whom ye have desired. Now, I haven't read that emphasis from myself. That's how the Bible is emphasized. That's how the emphasis is in the Hebrew text. Now therefore, behold the king whom ye have chosen and whom ye have desired. Behold, Yahweh hath set a king over you. And so he had. But the king that had been set over them was the king of the people's own choice. And Samuel's argument here is that having a king would still not secure their salvation unless they understood the lessons of the era of the judges. See, there's a play on his name here. You see verse 14, if you will fear the Lord and serve and obey his voice. You see the word obey, that's actually the word shema, to hearken, to hear. This is the basis of Samuel's own name, to obey the voice of God. If you won't shema God's voice, if you rebel, then the hand of God shall be against you, verse 15. And so he warns the nation that one has to learn to obey God's voice. And so the story of the thunder, in the middle of all this chapter, the story of the thunder from verses 16 to 19 was, we believe, designed to impress them with the need to do just that, to hear God's voice in their lives, that they might serve him faithfully. See what he says in verse 16. Now therefore, stand and see this great thing which Yahweh will do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest today? I will call unto Yahweh, and shall send thunder and rain, that ye may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which ye have done in the sight of Yahweh, in asking you a king. Now we're told in the book of Proverbs, and in chapter 26 and verse 1, these words. It says, as snow in summer, and as rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool. As snow in summer and rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool. In other words, that the idea of rain in harvest is, well, it's virtually impossible, says the proverb. It just doesn't happen. You don't get snow in summer, you don't get rain in winter, and you don't really have fools who have honor. It just doesn't happen. And you see, what the proverb says, by the way, is exactly correct, because when you go to the land of Israel and to the months of harvest, you have week after week after week after week of blue skies and burning sun, not a cloud in the sky, not a sniff of rain. And Samuel says, I'll ask Yahweh to do the impossible. I'll call unto Yahweh, and he shall send thunder and rain, so that you might see your wickedness. So you see, what Samuel is claiming here, I think in the 17th verse, is that this sign was going to be a warning to them. Did they now think that by having a king it would be impossible for them to fall? Then God would bring to pass the impossible, and he would make them fall if they would not hear him. And so we have the drama of this little episode here of the thunder and the rain. And so verse 18 says, so Samuel called unto Yahweh, And Yahweh sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared Yahweh and Samuel. You see, the word call aloud, by the way, verse 17 and 18, he called unto Yahweh. The dramatic spectacle of this happening. And as a result of that, it says God sent thunder and rain. But you see the word thunder there? The word thunder is the Hebrew word kol, Q-O-L, which means to call aloud. But it's the same word translated voice in verses 14 and 15. Now you see, in verses 14 and 15, Samuel has said, you've got to learn to obey the voice of God. So now God answers out of heaven, and there is the thunder. But that thunder is really the same word, voice. So you see, what the people really heard on this day was the voice of God thundering out of heaven. Actually, it reminds us of another passage. We might just come and have a look at this one. Do you remember this episode in John chapter 12? In John chapter 12, we have something that's really very interesting. It's very similar to the story, I think, of the thunder and rain of the first of Samuel 12. We're told there in verse 27 of John 12, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause came I unto this hour. Father, glorify thy name. Verse 28. Then came there a voice from heaven, saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. And the people therefore that stood by and heard it said that it thundered. Others said, an angel spake. Jesus said, this voice came not because of me, but because of your sakes. Now, isn't that remarkably similar to the story here of the first of Samuel chapter 12? The voice that came, not for Samuel, but for their sakes, that they might hear the voice of God. That had been his plea in this chapter. You must shema the voice of God. And all of a sudden they heard it. The almighty thunderings of the voice of God. You know, brothers and sisters, I think there's a lesson here, you see. You see, Samuel had heard that voice all his life. Hear God, heard of God. Samuel had always heard God's voice from the moment it whispered in his ear one night when he was a little boy. Samuel, Samuel. He'd always heard that voice. This had been the guiding principle of his life, hearing the voice of God. But you see, the problem was that the nation never ever did hear the voice of God or obey the voice. He says, right. He says, I'm going to show you that you've got to hear the voice of God. And he calls upon Yahweh, and Yahweh sends thunder and rain. And for the first time, some in the nation heard the voice of God. You know, brothers and sisters, sometimes we only ever hear the voice of God at Bible schools. And it thunders. It thunders out of the record of the divine page. And we hear the voice of God, and then we go home. We can't hear it anymore. So you see, the great challenge of life and the truth is to sustain that principle of how do we continue to hear the voice of God directing our lives, speaking into our ear. How do we hear those whispers and not just the thunder? And the answer is, well, we've got to give our lives and our hearts and our minds to the things of Scripture, don't we? This is where the voice of God is. This is where God speaks to us. The great objective of the truth is God manifestation, to make God plain in our lives. And we cannot understand the principles of God in any other way other than by having him speak to us from this book. And if he doesn't speak his principles to us, then we can't live them. And if we can't live them, then we cannot fulfill the great objective of the truth, which is to make him plain in our lives. And so on this dramatic day, the thunder arrived. Partly, I think, also, one of the reasons why Samuel would have done this is because, you see, the immediacy of the response would have impressed the nation with the fact that his words were true and that God listened to his prophet. And he presses home, doesn't he, in the 20th verse. He says, fear not, ye have done all this wickedness. And so he reminds them that what the thunder proved was what he'd claimed, is that they're in asking for a king, they had committed a matter of sin and of wickedness. but he still counsels the nation all the same. Despite the wickedness of the people, he gives them counsel as to what they ought to do in the course of their life as he offers this resignation speech. Now, just have a look at this then. So, you see, this is what Samuel says in summary in the course of this particular chapter. In verse 14, he says, "You should fear Yahweh and serve him." That's the great objective of it all, says Samuel. That's what you've got to be aiming to do. And to do that, you've got to first hear divine principles in your life. So he says, you've got to obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of Yahweh. This is the, you see, remember this, brothers and sisters. Remember that these are the words of an old man who's, this is the last thing he's going to say to the nation formally. Don't you think he'd choose his words with care? Wouldn't everything that he expressed on this day be, in Samuel's eyes, the most important things they could learn? So he says, you've got to obey the voice of God. That's it. And he says it must be passionate and committed and absolute. You've got to serve Yahweh with all your heart. God doesn't want indifferent service. God doesn't want Laodicean lukewarmness. God himself is a passionate being. I am a jealous God, he says. And he expects... You see, here's the logic of it, brothers and sisters. To me, there's a wonderful, simple logic to the truth, and that's this. If God Almighty is the supreme being of the universe, if he is, then he is surely worthy of our supreme affections and our supreme endeavors. Is anything less than that? Honoring to the Father, given his supremacy? So Samuel says, he says, you've got to serve him with all your heart. And that means, he says, that you can't deviate onto other things in life, other distractions, other interests. He says, you can't turn aside to other vain things. The truth demands unswerving concentration on the truth, not the other things of life. You know, it's true, isn't it? We all live in the world today, and how real the world is, our cars, our businesses, our homes, the cities. Everywhere about us, the world shrieks, this is real, this is real. It's not, brothers and sisters. We're living in a dream. Today is the illusion. Tomorrow is the reality. Tomorrow, the kingdom is the real thing. Today's just a time of preparation. Don't turn aside to vain things, says Samuel. They're all a distraction. And he says, I'm prepared to teach you the good and right way. The good and right way, he says. There's only one good and right way. And he says, that's the way of the truth. Oh, that you might learn that, he says. And then he reminds them at the end, verse 25, but if ye shall still do wickedly, ye shall be consumed. And so basically what he tells them is this. He says, look, God is able to forgive our sins in our strivings to serve him, in our strivings to hear and obey him. God will forgive our sins, but willful and stubborn disobedience will ultimately incur the divine retribution. Be warned, says Samuel, there is a choice, it's yours. But you can either have the blessing of God or the judgment of God. God is not mocked, he says. Now, where did Samuel get all that from? Well, you see, I think he got it from another man who delivered another resignation speech to the same nation, another trailblazer. Now, who would Samuel draw his inspiration from? See, I think that everything that Samuel says in this chapter is drawn from the book of Deuteronomy. You see the correspondences of thought there? If you will fear Yahweh and serve him, ye would not hear but rebel against the commandments. Serve him with all thy heart. Turn not aside. Do that which is good and right. If you turn away, you shall surely perish. Every single thought in Samuel's speech, I believe, is drawn from the book of Deuteronomy, which is, of course, Moses' resignation speech. How appropriate that should be, as he captures the very spirit of Moses of old in warning the nation concerning these things. You see what the people do in the middle of all this? They say in verse 19, after the drama of the thunder, they said, pray for thy servants unto Yahweh thy God, that we die not,
for we have added unto all our sins this evil to ask us a king. Don't stop praying for us.
In verse 23, interesting actually, he says, moreover, as for me, let it not be that I should sin against Yahweh in ceasing to pray for you. Now you see, the people had asked him in verse 19 if he would continue to pray for them. But you see, Samuel doesn't say, I won't sin against you in not praying. He says, I won't sin against God in not praying. In other words, Samuel saw his intercessory role on behalf of the nation as a joyful obligation in the truth in terms of his honor of God, not the people. Jeremiah chapter 15. You remember these words? Turn this one up because it's a good one. It's a good cross-reference. Jeremiah chapter 15 and verse 1. Let it not be that I should sin against Yahweh in ceasing to pray for you. These are famous words of Samuel. Now remember this in Jeremiah 15 verse 1. It says, then said Yahweh unto me, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my mind could not be towards this people, cast them out of thy sight. Now why does God say to Jeremiah here in chapter 15 verse 1, he says, look, even if Moses and Samuel were before me, I still couldn't listen to this people. And the answer is, because Moses and Samuel were regarded as the two greatest intercessors of the nation in prayer to God. And so they brought together the two men that had offered the greatest intercessory prayers on behalf of Israel. He says, look, even their prayers would not change my mind. And he brings those two men together. And you see, I think there's a marvelous lesson here concerning Samuel. He's not just Samuel the upright. He's not just Samuel the counselor. He's Samuel the intercessor in the matter of praying for his people. What a wonderful spirit this man had. He was a man of prayer throughout all his life. We're told that his name was indicative of the power of his prayers because Shema El means heard of God. In other words, the prayers of this man were efficacious. God heard this man's prayers. We believe that his prayers were characterized by a particular cry which aroused the divine response. And there's a play upon his name in at least two passages in the divine record. In the first of Samuel 7, it says, Samuel cried unto Yahweh, and Yahweh heard him, Shema. And again in Psalm 99, Samuel, among all them that call upon his name, they called upon Yahweh, and he answered them, heard of God. And so his whole ministry, we believe, was characterized by prayer to God and converse with God, so that he became associated with Moses as one of the greatest intercessors of the nation. And this, brothers and sisters, all for a people so thoughtless, so unspiritual, so wicked at this particular moment as they were in asking for a king and in rejecting the divine rulership of Almighty God over them. What a marvelous spirit from this man as he offers these closing thoughts to the nation. No self-vindication, no self-glory, only a concern for that which would be right for the people of God. A wonderful spirit, brothers and sisters, for us all to follow. The spirit of a man whose integrity and whose care for his people we can emulate. The lessons of that day in Israel's history when Samuel called unto Yahweh, and Yahweh sent thunder.